702. The Naked Scientist.
It's 25 minutes to 3 o'clock. Earlier, I asked you about your children's feedback, you know, coming home from school. This is the time when they would be returning. What is their feedback if they're in grade 7 and 12 about that first day back? A mom from Rivalea says, my son goes to a public school, grade 12. He just got home now. They only received two masks as opposed to a kit that the MEC, Banyaza Lesufi, spoke about on air. What a joke. Otherwise, he says school was not that bad. So keep that feedback coming. Be interesting to hear how your kids experienced, you know, this so-called new normal. They have to slip into a new normal seamlessly and, of course, keep up with the academic expectations for this year. And we will be right with them, of course, supporting them through the process as their parents. But we're taking your calls right now. It is the segment where we chat to the naked scientist, Chris Smith, Dr. Chris Smith, joining us every single Monday on the live. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Azza. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Big day as kids are going back to school today. There was a phased reopening that started last week, but the bulk, some schools were ready, but the bulk of kids went back today for grade 7 and grade 12. So only two grades for now, and the rest will follow in coming weeks. But yeah, big day, big day.
Yeah, well, we've already had all this, of course. Not for our older ones, but the little ones have gone back, or at least some of them have. Some older ones will be going back a bit later on in the year, but for most children, it remains education at home, and it's really stressing the system because I know many parents, including some who are themselves school teachers, and they say, this home education business, you know, give me school in the classroom any day, because I realize why teachers are teachers and why I'm not if you're not a teacher. And those that are teachers are saying, when it's your own kids, it's a lot harder to try and teach
yes.
them.
Yes. Yes, even kids are valuing their teachers because they think they can see how difficult it is to learn on their own. So they're appreciating them so much more.
That's right. It's also the socialization side of it, though, isn't it? Because a lot of children are saying they are desperate to go back to school and see a change of scenery and a change of company, because they're really missing their friends and the social interactions. And I think this is something that's very easy to overlook, is the importance of the social side of the developing person's brain. You know, when you're growing up, you need that interaction with other people, young and old, in order to become well-rounded and develop your personality and your social skills and so on. And if you're robbed of that opportunity, it can have enormous consequences. So I really feel for younger people who have been feeling quite isolated and quite lonely in recent weeks.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we'll see how this evolves. Let's get to the calls. We've got Bev first up calling from Springs. Chris, hello, Bev.
Hi, Azania. A couple of weeks ago, you asked Chris, good afternoon, Chris. You asked Chris about the effect of altitude on coronavirus death. And, you know, it just seems that we're seeing so many more deaths in the coastal areas than we are up in Gauteng, which is, you know, very populated. And we have a lot of cases, but we just don't seem to have the same death rate. I just wondered if Chris had managed to look at some of that research.
Bev, okay. I haven't found any more information relating death rate to altitude yet. Obviously, if you've got a viral infection that damages your lungs, it will make life at higher altitude where there's already less oxygen and the system is already stressed more difficult. But it will come down to how easy it is that it spreads among people, first point. If you've got people living in dense populations, it probably will spread more than in areas where people are more dispersed, because obviously there are fewer opportunities for it to spread. But also the kinds of populations that live at higher altitudes, and we're talking not just a bit higher, we're talking really high altitudes. People in across the South American continent, for example, in some parts of Chile, for example, very, very high altitude. Those individuals might have something special about them that means they're more likely to cope better with the kinds of situations that put you in low oxygen already, and therefore they may cope better when they get coronavirus infections. They may already have other changes that mean they're less susceptible. At the moment, we just don't know. People are trying to explore this, because the other interesting thing is that ethnicity has emerged as a potential risk factor in some countries. In the UK, for example, if you are from an ethnic minority group, your risk of dying from coronavirus could be, in some cases, 100% higher than, say, a person who is white. Now, what we don't understand is that because there is something genetic going on here? Are certain ethnic groups carrying certain genes, or is it that the environment that they are living in has been hit harder? Is it the age profile of that particular demographic group? We don't know, because people were very nervous when we thought, well, we're going to start to see a lot of cases across the African continent from coronavirus. What is this going to do to that population? And in fact, there seems to be much lower levels of activity than we would have anticipated. And some people are speculating, including my colleague who's currently working in Nigeria to try to help the effort there. They're seeing far fewer serious cases than they had planned for. And they're thinking that age may be part of it, but they just don't know. So right now we're collecting samples and we're doing various bits of research to try to understand why it is that we're seeing these interesting trends emerging. But at the moment, we have no clear picture, Bev. I'm really sorry. It's a great question, but we just don't know.
Bev, thank you so much for that question. I also read a number of articles in The Guardian, for instance, looking at this issue that you raised about what you were calling BAME in the UK. I think Black Asian ethnic minorities in the UK. But, you know, some, as you said, there is this debate going on, and some are saying it's simply about the socioeconomic conditions that people are living in. They live in areas.
Now, the reason I agree with that, and I think it probably is very heavily dominated by the socioeconomics in terms of how many people share a house, for example, what sorts of jobs certain people do, where they tend to work, where they tend to live.
Healthcare.
All these factors are going to play a really big part. And the thing that really struck me was when Public Health England published the report on this, if you look at the people who are listed as at higher risk, then it's not just, say, one particular ethnic group. Now, if it was some kind of genetic or biochemical susceptibility, you would expect there to be one outlying group that stand out as they're at really high risk and other groups are at lower risk. But it was basically everyone who is from all groups had some kind of risk escalation. And that doesn't really fit with what we understand about genetics and human evolution and so on. There's the greatest diversity in genetics in the African continent, and it narrows and bottlenecks as you go away from the African continent across the world. So it doesn't really fit when you look at who's succumbing to this. So that's what's telling me it doesn't seem to be a genetic thing. It's more likely to be something to do with the socioeconomic factors that are playing up. But we are actively looking at this because if we find out why some groups are much more susceptible, that may enable us to understand why they're more susceptible. And if we understand the why or the mechanism of the disease, you then understand how you can try and attack the disease and stop that happening.
No, absolutely. What's his name? Winston Morgan, a toxicologist, wrote, and he concluded his piece by saying, the evidence suggests that this coronavirus does not discriminate, but highlights existing discriminations and the continued prevalence of ideas about race today, despite the lack of any scientific basis, shows how these ideas can mutate to provide justification for the power structures that have ordered our society since the 18th century. And he was making the case as well, as you say now, about the diversity that exists amongst the people who are most affected, and what they do have in common are the socioeconomic conditions that they live in the US, in the UK, and so on. So we are studying this as we go along, no doubt. Let's see what other questions there are now. There's Martha calling from Bosmont with a question. Hello, Martha.
Hi. We are going into winter now. Most of our people use electrical heaters in a room. Now, I want to know, if a teacher who has 20 children in her room uses an electric heater, what effect could that have on the children? Because we know the effect that it dries up the air. With coronavirus, what do we think would happen?
Okay. People are very interested in the whole question of air circulation and, say, air conditioning, because we've suddenly realized that we've been for donkey's ages building buildings and formatting living spaces so that the aircon can distribute cool air everywhere. But the problem is that that means if there's viruses hovering in the cool air, they're going to go everywhere as well, and the same for warm air. So we're going to have to rethink how we send airflow around rooms and buildings, both to maximize comfort but to minimize the spread of infection, which had been completely overlooked prior to all of this. So if you create an airflow in a room This will mean that there is a traffic of air from one area to another. And if there's one person standing upwind in that room, then anything they're breathing out is going to get carried all over the room along those air currents to hit the other people in the room. And this was actually documented by people right at the beginning of this coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan, where they went to a restaurant. They found an individual who had gone out to dinner with a number of friends. They had themselves been infectious. A number of people they were sitting with at their table picked it up directly from them, but then other people around the restaurant picked it up because the air from the air conditioning unit blew the virus from their table to all the other tables. So it's certainly true that you will distribute virus when you distribute air, potentially, but warm air is not likely to make much of a difference when you're warming it up just enough to make it comfortable for a person, because to be honest with you, the virus is already on, it's got a limited time clock running when it's out of your body. It will only run around in the air for a number of minutes to hours. So it's going to disappear eventually anyway. So most of the infections are going to be because you're sharing air for a long period of time with somebody. And the more opportunities you present the infection to spread around the airspace, the more efficiently it's going to spread. So I'd say whether it's a heater or a fan, if you've got someone who's upwind of that, their germs are going to blow all over the place.
Right. Martha, interesting question. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Thank you. That's Martha in Bosmont. Eunice, you're calling from Kilani. Hi.
Yeah, hi there, Zanya. My question to Chris is, initially when this coronavirus broke, we were told that literally in Africa, millions and millions of people will die. But it hasn't happened and hopefully doesn't happen. But the point is, someone then said, and I read it somewhere, that Africa's got compulsory malaria and yellow fever vaccinations, which Europe and the Americas don't have. Is there any truth to that, therefore, that the rates are much higher in Europe and America because they don't have compulsory vaccinations? Is there any truth to that?
I'm not aware of any relationship between yellow fever vaccination and protecting people. One speculation might be that because some malaria prophylaxis includes chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, perhaps that's playing a role, because that was Donald Trump's favorite drug, if you remember. But actually, trials that are now being done on individuals with severe coronavirus infection who've been given hydroxychloroquine, they haven't really shown any benefit compared to people who haven't had hydroxychloroquine. So that probably isn't the reason. But one intriguing thing that's been observed is that countries where there's a high use of the BCG vaccination, and that's the vaccine that's given to individuals to protect them from TB, those individuals have a very low risk compared to people who haven't, in countries with a no BCG program, the risk is very different. So in some way, this vaccine, which is being given to protect people against TB, seems to be associated with protecting people against severe coronavirus infection. Now, it might be an association rather than a causal relationship. In other words, there is no real relationship. It just happens that they're cropping up together by chance. But it does appear to be quite a robust observation. Why this is, we don't know, but it argues that perhaps it's doing something to the immune system in the recipients of the BCG, and perhaps that in turn changes a person's susceptibility to COVID. And perhaps naturally being infected with TB also changes your immune response a bit. We know that the vast majority of the billions of people who are infected with TB around the world, a very large proportion of people in the African continent, in sub-Saharan Africa, have TB infection or have been exposed to TB infection. So perhaps the same thing's naturally going on with that infection as is going on in countries where people are being given a weakened form of that infection to protect them from TB. So perhaps there is something in this, but it's not so much malaria and yellow fever. Perhaps it's got more to do with tuberculosis or vaccination against tuberculosis. And people are actively pursuing this as well.
Yeah, so those studies are still happening at the moment for the understanding
That's
of
right.
BCG still on. We got a question via email, and I hope it's clear enough. John says, how do spacecrafts and recently the SpaceX Dragon 9 stop when they arrive at the International Space Station? Do they apply brakes? And if so, what provides the friction for the brakes, for the brake to hold? Considering that ISS, the International Space Station, is constantly moving and there's no gravity in space.
Oh, there's lots of gravity in space. Because if you think about it, the International Space Station is orbiting the Earth. If there was no gravity, there'd be nothing to hang on to the ISS, and it would fly off in a straight line away from the Earth. It doesn't. It goes around in a circle because the ISS is being pulled towards the Earth continuously, and the Earth is being pulled towards the ISS a little bit continuously. The result is that one orbits the other. When a rocket blasts off from the Earth's surface, it has to achieve what is called orbital velocity. If the rocket's going fast enough, what will happen is it will accelerate away from the Earth's surface, and it will get into a position in space where it is always being pulled back down towards the Earth, but as it falls towards the Earth, because the Earth's surface is curved, the Earth is curving out of the way of the thing that's orbiting it, so that the thing is always falling towards the Earth but missing. So when you end up with a thing in orbit like the International Space Station, it will be going around the Earth at a certain velocity. In order to dock with the International Space Station, your rocket has to get to the same altitude above the Earth and therefore be going at the same speed. So it will go out from the Earth's surface, it will get to orbital velocity, and then it will get into the same orbital path as the ISS, and to get the speed matched, what they use are thrusters. What these thrusters do is they apply force, because what you're basically doing is ejecting gas very hard in one direction, which means you get a push in the equal and opposite direction, and this enables you to match your position and your speed to the ISS. And it's a very, very painstaking maneuver. You need careful mathematicians, clever people, and computer programs to work it out for you. SpaceX did it by having a computer do everything. The pilots did almost nothing for all this. It was all worked out in advance. And you basically get your two craft lined up, get the speeds matched, and then the new craft that's coming in just slowly creeps up, very, very slowly, by firing thrusters to give tiny amounts of push to catch up with the craft it's going to dock with. And then the two come together at very low velocity for safety, and then they dock, and that's it. But there's nothing to slow you down in space. So when you give something a push, it just carries on going forever in that direction, because there's no way for it to slow down. And that's why you have to use thrusters instead.
Yes, wow. All those years of watching Star Trek,
you realize how much artistic license there was in that program. I love Star Trek, and it's amazing how much of Star Trek has actually come to pass, isn't it? You remember things like the mobile communicators, and in the next generation of Star Trek, we're all amazed when they would sort of tap on their badge and then talk to the computer wherever they were on the spaceship. And people have home, you know, home speakers and things now, and you know, Alexa devices and Google assistants and so on, and they work in exactly that way. And what was shown there 20, 30, 40 years ago is all coming to pass, with the exception of transporters. We always wanted one of those, didn't we? And the fact that these spacecraft magically make gravity somehow, they haven't kind of solved that one yet either.
No, they haven't, and I can't wait for a time when we can just teleport, you know, or beam me up, Scotty, and Scotty on the other side saying, "I cannot do it, Captain. I cannot do it." But Noam Chomsky talks about it as
that would save me having to fly everywhere, wouldn't it? Because it would do away with the problem of having to go through airport security, which I would absolutely love.
No. I'm signing up for that. Beam me up any day. But Noam Chomsky describes that as manufactured consent. You know, that the arts have been there and doing what they've been doing for so long that when these technologies do come our way, we're not surprised, because the idea has been presented to us through film for so long. So what the things you were describing that are here today, we'd seen and of course had accepted them thanks to the film.
But they don't shock anymore. They don't amaze anymore.
No.
Because everyone goes, yeah, so what? If my children watch an episode of Star Trek these days, they see these people walking around with these enormous things like a massive overgrown mobile phone. And they say, cool, that's a bit of a pathetic gadget, isn't it? Come look at the size of that. Whereas in my day, we would look at that and go, oh, my God, can you imagine if you could do that? Wouldn't that be phenomenal?
Yes, the fact that it was mobile and not tied to the wall in any way was the fascination. Let's go to JJ in Mamelodi in Pretoria. Hello, JJ.
Hi, Azra and your guest, Chris Day. How are you?
Hi, JJ.
We're good.
Great. One question I wanted to ask has just been stolen, but let me start with this one, GMT, Greenwich Mean Time. I heard through the eyewitness news last time that it was going to be increased with 7 minutes or so, and then the question I want to pose is, how do they configure that GMT, and what is the relationship with us down south here? And the last one will be the aerospace tourism. Within this race that we are seeing between the America, China, and all that, how are they going to configure a hotel or a place? Because they're talking of aerospace tourism and all that. I'll listen on the radio. Thank you.
Oh, grand, fantastic questions, JJ. Thank you. Yes, so Green Meridian time.
Right, well, let's
first.
Talk about GMT first. Well, when people first started sailing all around the Earth, they could work out pretty easily where they were going from north to south, between the North Pole and the South Pole, because they could look at the positions of stars and things, and they therefore knew pretty easily where they were. What they had no idea was, when they were going round the Earth, so east-west, they had no idea how far they'd gone. Because until you can actually work out roughly how far you've moved with time, it's impossible to know where you are across the Earth's surface because the Earth is turning. And so you can look for the stars. They'll tell you how far north or south you are, but you've no idea how far across you are because, of course, the turning of the Earth means the stars move across the sky. So you don't know what time it is of day. And therefore, if you know when the stars are supposed to be at a certain position in the sky at a certain time, if you don't know the time, you therefore have no idea where you are. So yeah. This became a big problem for early mariners and seafarers, and it led to something called the Longitude Prize. And a number of people put forward entries, and it was a very, very large sum of money for the 1700s when all this happened, for someone to win to be able to make a timepiece, a clock that could run reliably at sea and keep accurate time despite the fact that boats are rocking and rolling and waves are bashing them all over the place. And there were many, many entries for this, but the person who actually won the prize was John Harrison, who was an inventor, a watchmaker, and he produced a watch which did keep accurate time at sea. And this meant that then you could go sailing across the sea. You knew exactly what time of day it was. So you could look at the stars and you knew how far across the sky they should be at any given time. And then you knew how far across the ocean you were. So you could tell north to south, and you could also do east to west, which is a very, very important discovery. Of course, you needed a reference point, what you were going to call the time for all your star charts and so on. So Greenwich Mean Time was, here's the time through the middle of London at Greenwich, where the Naval College is. And then we're going to divide the Earth up into a series of slices, which are like segments of an orange. And then those are your lines of longitude around the Earth's surface, which you can work out based on time. Because you know what time of day it is, because you've now got an accurate clock. So GMT was just because the geezers in London invented the clock. They invented the way of doing this amazing feat of navigation with timekeeping. So therefore, it was sensible, since England pretty much ruled the Earth, didn't it, one time? So they decided that was going to be Greenwich Mean Time, GMT, much to the consternation of America, who's been trying to steal it off us ever since. In terms of space hotels, interesting one, this one. The thing is, this is suggested it's going to be the next big boon in terms of tourism. We'll jump aboard a rocket like the SpaceX that's now becoming a tractable thing to do. This will take you up to some orbiting hotel like the International Space Station. You can go and have a holiday in space in microgravity. I'm not sure it will be a very nice holiday, though, because floating around with no gravity for a period of time, people think, well, that sounds like fun, but actually it makes you feel really sick. And I think there'd be a lot of people getting very seasick very quickly. I'm not sure it'd be a very good holiday for me.
Yeah, like you did say last week, that going up in space really is bad for the body. It's been very bad. Derek asked a question last week about face shields. So are face shields better than face masks, and how do face shields protect from COVID-19?
Okay, Derek. Well, when governments are talking about this, they're talking about either face masks or face coverings. They're doing this because they want to distinguish between the kinds of surgical or hospital face masks that healthcare workers may use and the kinds of face coverings that people are being urged to use if they can't observe social distancing. When you're in a hospital, you're likely to meet patients who are highly infectious and they could infect you. So you wear a surgical or a proper protective face mask that filters out what goes through it so that you are not going to get infected. If you're out and about in public or on public transport, for instance, the guidance is if you make a face covering, what that can do is to help to reduce the droplets that you're spitting and spraying out when you breathe and talk. And if you do that, you will reduce the spread of those droplets to other people who are around you And if you can't stay more than a couple of meters away from each other because you're being packed into a train or you're in a busy shopping center and you're worried you can't stay a decent distance from people, this is why this may help, because it means that it's a replacement up to a point for being able to do social distancing. But none of these masks or anything are as good as social distancing, which is the most effective way to stop yourself catching the infection.
Right. Chris, we're out of time. It's a date next week, next week Monday. Look at me changing.
Thanks, Tazza, very much indeed. Monday. Have a great week. See you soon.
Thank you. That was Dr. Chris Smith.